another episode of Untold, the podcast where we go behind the scenes, speak to founders and business leaders about their journeys. We've had a cracking series so far. We've discussed all sorts, and I'm absolutely pumped to continue today. We have a wonderful guest who I know is going to make your tummies rumble at home, and you're going to be dashing out to buy some unbelievably bloody tasty Italian pizza. It's Nick from White Rabbit. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm good, mate. Thank you for having me.
Oh no, thank you for coming on. It's wonderful to have you in. I think as a brand, I've been incredibly inspired by what you guys have done, and I think it's class. I love the product. I think it's really good. So it's great to sort of meet you properly and have you on Untold. The way that we like to kick these off is if you could give us a bit of color behind yourself, how the brand came to fruition, like where it came from. I tried to like do a couple where I did the intros, yeah. and I just butchered them and was like, it's gonna be so much better coming from the horse's mouth. So like crack on, man, it's all yours.
Yeah, sure. So I graduated in 2013. I grew up in Oxford, so I moved back from Bristol to Oxford, yeah, after I graduated. I got a job in the White Rabbit pub where a few of my friends were working. That's where I met Matteo, who at the time was just some random bloke from Italy who couldn't speak a word of English. I had no idea that a year down the line I'd be starting a business with him.
Amazing.
But yeah, I met him. He was making his incredible pizzas at the pub, and we were getting a lot of requests for gluten-free and plant-based alternatives to those, yeah, pizzas. And that's essentially where we had the idea. So yeah, we did a road trip to Italy.
Love it.
His driving is terrifying. Honestly, we still talk about it today.
That's so good.
But yeah,
I can imagine like all of Italy is pretty terrifying driving, right?
Yeah, well, he's sort of like indicating is optional to turn. Like, he drives like no one else is on the road.
So good.
But yeah, we made it. We made it to his house in Bergamo. We were doing a load of recipe development and getting ingredients. And I think after that trip, we felt like we were people that we could go into business, but, you know, yeah, that it would work out. And, yeah, and I trusted him. And so, yeah, we spent the next kind of year developing the recipe and using customers at the pub as ready-made feedback for the products we were developing.
Yeah.
We rented a little kitchen above the pub and paid the landlady in gluten-free bases. That was our rent. Got one of the old dough mixes that she didn't need anymore and used that. About a year later, we had a product that we were happy with at the time. And we kind of pitched the idea to Philippa, who's still the owner of the White Rabbit Pub.
Yeah.
And she loved the idea and gave us our first capital, basically.
Amazing.
So she's still a major shareholder and a non-exec in the business. And
oh my God,
we love her. She's an amazing woman, and she was there for us emotionally, physically, financially, everything for the first, yeah, 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
With that, we got a kind of tiny 700 square foot kitchen in East Oxfordshire, and Teo was literally making all the pizzas on his own. And I was going back and forth to London, having meetings with Planet Organic and Whole Foods and Abel and Cole and those, yeah, kind of more boutique independent stores.
Yeah.
That was where we got our first listings. That was in January 2016. I think we launched with Planet Organic, and soon after followed by, yeah, the Whole Foods, Abel and Cole.
Amazing.
And kind of 6 years later, we're now in the a few of the multinationals, so Sainsbury's, Waitrose, Ocado, Co-op,
yeah,
Morrison's. We now have 10,000 square foot in that same business park that we got our original, man, kitchen on, and a team of 40 to 50 people working in the wow, bakery. So it's no longer just Teo on his own.
That's amazing.
But yeah.
Is his driving still that bad?
Yeah, it's but he never crashes.
Yeah, like,
he never has any issues. I don't know. It's
amazing.
A miracle, really.
Love it.
Yeah.
Man, I mean, what a story. I think I love doing this. I'm so lucky to do what I do, because I get to listen to like really inspirational people tell their story, and I think that is so cool. I think one thing I'd love to delve into a little bit more is like what happened. So you meet Teo in the pub, in the White Rabbit, and so like we then sort of fast forwarded a year to setting up the business. Like talk before that, talk us about kind of what happened to get to that point. Does that make sense?
I think I always wanted to work for myself. I think genuinely, partly because I found the idea of having a normal job terrifying. And I still have never really had a normal job, to be honest, other than a temping job. And I got fired after 2 days because I filed wrong. I think I've always known I wanted to do that. I just never knew what it would look like. I didn't, you know, my grandparents were immigrants. They're Cypriot. They came over in the 50s and worked really hard to eventually have their own businesses. And I think me and my siblings always looked up to that and the security that that provided. And I think we always respected that. So I think I always knew I wanted to do it. I just had no idea what it would look like, but I knew if the opportunity came, I'd grab it with both hands.
Yeah.
And in Teo, genuinely, his product as well, but in him as a person, I think I saw someone that was like, this could work. Definitely. Yeah,
amazing.
So we just picked up and run. He had always had the idea of doing alternative versions of his family recipe. So his uncle has a pizzeria in Milan.
Yeah.
He always worked at, he hates me saying this, but he came in the top five of the Pizza Olympics. He's going to hate me saying this, but he hates it when I bring it up, but it's such a cool thing. Yeah. It was in Milan.
The Pizza Olympics.
It's actually a thing. It's genuinely a thing. I think he came like fourth or seventh or something. Anyway,
amazing.
He'd always had the idea of doing kind of alternative versions of his family recipes.
Yeah.
But I guess he'd just moved to England, so didn't necessarily have the confidence or the language skills at that point. So that was, I guess that's where I came in.
Yeah.
The more we looked up and down the supermarket aisles, the more we realized that no one was kind of challenging that space, really.
Yeah.
The pizza space.
It's nuts. It's crazy how wide open that no one is challenging it, right?
Until you get in it, you realize, you know, maybe there's reasons why.
It's difficult.
It's a high barrier to entry because there's a kind of couple of big scary players there who have dominated for decades.
Yeah.
I guess the good thing about that is once you're over that hurdle, it's one more hurdle for the next person to get over if they try and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fascinating, man. I think it's super cool, and I want to cut. There's so much to unpick, but I want to make sure that we stick to our roots at Untold, where we sort of go behind the brand and we go behind like the challenging times for the founding team and your sort of personal journey through this.
Yeah,
have you enjoyed the journey so far?
I've enjoyed. There's been parts that obviously I've enjoyed.
Yeah.
I think I've enjoyed what it's given to me and what I've learned and the people I've met.
Yeah.
But like, I haven't enjoyed all of it. No. Yeah, be a psychopath to say that. Honestly.
I love that mentality. I love that mentality because I'm sure there are people out there that'll be like, yeah, man, of course. Why wouldn't I love it? Like,
yeah.
I love that. And so we're going to sort of come on to different bits, but talk me through a tough time that you have come through with the business, and we're out the other side now, and you can reflect on that and go, I can now part some learnings to people that are listening here that might go through something similar or are going through something on their own. Talk me through a time when that happened.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I guess the one that sticks out is the kind of the, I guess the first time the wind really got knocked out of our sails. So we very quickly launched. Sainsbury's actually approached us in 2017, and we got a listing fairly soon after. In early 2018, we launched with Ocado and Waitrose, and you know we were the only people doing it in the space. Our rate of sale was crazy. Like at that point, we were flying, and then like very quickly, literally overnight, suddenly loads of own label competition launched. Pizza Express launched a vegan pizza, slightly less expensive than we were. And within the space of a few months, our sales were declining. And it was basically the first kind of wake up call that actually, you know, there is a market for it.
Yeah.
But because there's a market for it, everyone else is now going to try and eat that up and take that back off us. And it's people aren't just going to let us take that space.
Yeah.
So it got to the point where we were going to be delisted from Waitrose, which was our second biggest account. And I think at that stage, given we had invested pretty heavily in the bakery, would have been fairly terminal, to be honest, not to have that volume going through the bakery.
Yeah.
But we basically just got back round the table, like asked some really honest honest questions about where the product was at and how we needed to step the product on, because you know, like, it was fine when we were the only people doing it, but now there was competition and we needed to always be one step ahead of the game and move the goalposts again. So
Both I guess in terms of availability and marketing, but also in product taste, texture, everything to do with that as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. And essentially, I mean, this is pretty niche, but it was a big step change in our product. At the time, we were, you know, almost the only people doing a chilled gluten-free base. We had a kind of a much flatter crust. It wasn't a raised dough. And Teo basically redeveloped the recipe, designed a kind of bespoke bit of machinery that would allow it to have a proper raised crust like a normal dough would.
Amazing.
So we took that to the Waitrose buyer, kind of got her on board and said, you know, this is going to make the difference. We were in sleeves at the time, but we did boxes, so that protected the product more. I mean, loads of learnings that, you know, we took on board since we launched and we did it. And yeah, rate of sales started creeping up again and we saved our listing. So I guess that was the first kind of the first time we had a big setback.
Yeah.
And selling the product wasn't easy. And actually we had some competition that we had to get ahead of again. But then more recently, I mean, last year we had a product recall, which was really tough because it was nothing to do with us, basically. And you know, you work so hard to protect your and it's irrelevant that it wasn't to do with us because it's still your brand that suffers at the end of the day, and that's the most pain. I almost would prefer it was. Yeah, I probably would have preferred it if it was our fault.
I completely hear what you're
saying. But yeah, it wasn't, but it's still our brand at the end of the day. So that was pretty heartbreaking.
You've got to take the punches as
absolutely. Right? Definitely.
Oh mate, like the amount of people we could speak to that have been through similar experiences that there's a recall that's not my fault and we're now I mean, you look at some brands that have been decimated.
I know.
It's got nothing to do with them. Fucking hell, like it's.
Yeah, there's enough stuff that goes wrong that is your fault.
Like, yeah. You don't need. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like where is like? Yeah, I mean, crazy. At The Savourist, we can't run our own podcast and not talk about our wonderful snacks. We have a range of crunchets which are made from edamame, black bean, puff rice. They're bundled together and seasoned with Thai chili or sizzling barbecue. They pack a punch of crunch and are honestly the go-to snack that you should be heading for in your cupboard. They're high protein, they're low calorie, and our mission is to end the healthy, tasty tension. It says it all, really. Healthy snacks that taste absolutely banging. Head on over to our website and grab some. Ta-da. I think one of the big things there, I guess, like that, I mean, there's so much to unpick, and we will unpick it all. Mm-hmm. But the big thing that I saw was that you said you moved into the cardboard around the pizza, like the boxes.
Yeah,
that seems like a really smart move because you look at it now and you're like, there's so much real estate there versus a sleeve.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a classic example of you go in thinking that. Oh, why isn't anyone else? We tried to be clever and do it in sleeves because it was cheaper. And And then again, you realize there's a reason everyone uses boxes. It's because your product will get mashed and there's way less real estate, like you say, for branding. Yeah. So I don't know if it was a smart move more than just, you know,
going through it, learning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. it's much better now.
I think that the biggest thing really, which I love, and I love this podcast for this, is you go through that, you're going like, well, yeah, when then we realized that we had some competitors, and like you've gone from being in the White Rabbit pub to going out to Italy doing this sourcing trip. And when you say competitors, like, you don't mean like someone else launching a pizza brand, you mean like Pizza Express.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
like, it's nuts when you think about it like that, right?
Yeah.
Like, in a year, you've gone White Rabbit Pub, you've met your co-founder, you've gone out to Italy, you're now, we're fast forward, you're in a factory, and your competitor is now Pizza Express. Like, there's no fucking in between. It's like pub to Pizza Express. It's mental, man. I think it's amazing.
Thank
like,
you so much.
And it's such a cool way at taking a step back and looking at what you've achieved as a challenger brand. And I think it's very... the essence of this podcast is to talk about the harder times and to give people the kind of confidence and I guess like wrap arms around people to go like, look, these guys have gone out and done it and they're in supermarkets and they've, of course, they've been through hard times as well.
Yeah,
but it's also really key to celebrate that like unbelievable success. And I can't remember who we were talking to, but the other day we were interviewing someone and we were saying how when you take a step back and as challenger brand founders, we all operate in a world where we all know each other's brands and you kind of compare yourselves to like the Jimmy's Iced Coffees, the Mojus, the Pippa Nuts. And everyone's always like that one step further than you guys. But when you take yourself out of it and go like, I've got a mate called Luca who's a great bloke and he works in the city. Mm. He earns a load of money, but he doesn't run his own business and he thinks what we do is fucking insane.
Yeah.
When you look at it like that, you're like, actually, this is proper cool.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Amazing. Okay, so I want to come back to like, how did you feel personally? Like, how did you get through that moment where you're like, all these other brands are launching other versions that are cheaper, and by cheaper it's because they can get the scale instantly and they know it, right? How did you feel personally?
I think the kind of the slightly inconvenient truth of things like this is like, it's when things go wrong or when something like that happens, like big competition enters the market, that those are the times when you really step change your business.
Yeah.
And I guess the biggest driver for me is fear of failure.
Yeah.
It's fear of not making it to the end versus what you might get at the end, if that makes sense.
The
people who have believed in you and backed you and all the time, you know, you've spent telling your friends and family about it and answering their questions, like all of that, the idea of that all being for nothing. And I know it's not, you know, it wouldn't be for nothing. Like I would have learned a lot and all that, but at the time that's basically,
it feels like all or nothing.
I think that's the driver to it just being like, that can't happen. Like whatever we've got to do, we'll do it.
Yeah.
I know like the words like agility and pivoting and like, I'm sick to death of those words, but like, and I guess what you may not see from the outside is that I guess a lot of the time you pivot or you're agile is out of necessity.
Yeah.
It's not like we just prance around like thinking how we can pivot. Usually pivot because you have to.
Yeah, 100%. Pivoting has become this like world-class marketing buzzword. But
yeah, you wouldn't like, pivot if you didn't have to.
If it worked, you just keep doing
exactly,
more of it,
right? Exactly.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's come up. It's a sexy way of saying like this isn't working, really.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah, so I guess it's the first time we really had to do that, and it's always been our journey to date has been full of those moments, really. But you always come out, like I said, the biggest improvements to your business always come after those moments.
Yeah.
If there's a market for what you're doing, someone else is always going to try and do it. And
100%.
It's about moving the goalposts.
How you stay on top and
yeah.
That's
exactly.
The buzz of the brand. That's where the brand piece comes in as well, right?
Exactly.
Like the story of you guys going over to Italy and Teo not being able to turn left or right without putting it in there. Like, I mean, it all adds to it all, right?
Definitely.
It's amazing. I love how the authenticity about you guys meeting in the White Rabbit Pub is amazing. Yeah. Like, it hasn't really got anything to do with pizza. It's class.
Thank you.
I love it. And there's a real brand built there. I think the a lot of sort of what that fear of failure piece, I think is really important, because a lot of people go, and I think it kind of comes into both, right? Pivoting, failing fast, fear of failure. I think what I love about the way that you look at it is like, failure is the business doesn't exist anymore, and you're not gonna to you, that's what that means. That doesn't mean that's what it should be doesn't mean that's what everyone else thinks. It's just to you personally that is, if the business doesn't exist anymore, that's what scares you.
Yeah.
But the actual individual failings of kind of, okay, it's not really failing, but how do we make the crust puff a bit so that it tastes a bit more like another pizza, is so key to the success. But the failure part and the where do you think that's being driven from, other than letting people down? Is it inside you? Rich from Mojo explains this really well, where he's like, you just give yourself, he calls it no optionality. He's like, you just don't give yourself an option for it to not work. Like, you have to go. What's that being driven by?
I think I always had a very clear idea of what I wanted to do with the business when we started, and until we get to that point, you know, that's not success to me, which, to be honest, is why I haven't been on a podcast yet, because I almost felt like I hadn't earned the right to kind of come here and like spout my wisdom. I have, you know, clearly what I want to achieve with the business, and I'm not there yet. And so doing something like this before that point, I don't know. It didn't quite sit right with me.
I love it.
Yeah, but sorry, what was your question?
No. It was.
Where does the fear of failure come from?
Where's that being driven from?
Yeah, so I think not getting to that point, and I also think, kind of counterintuitively, I think normally, I guess you'd think that it would get easier. Every hurdle, every near miss you have, every hurdle you get over, every problem you solve, you'd think it gets easier, but it doesn't. It gets harder, because every time you do that, it's one more reason why it can't all be for nothing.
Yeah.
Like every time you've, you know, killed yourself trying to solve a problem, and you've done it and you've made it, or, you know, every time part of your personal life has suffered for the business, every time that happens, it's just more of that weight. You're like adding to the weight of, this can't be all for nothing.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, mate, 100%.
So that almost grows. It doesn't diminish. It grows, I think, over time.
Yeah.
And it's offset by, okay, we're now a, you know, 6-7-year-old business, and, you know, we got X amount of revenue and certain size behind us. So that kind of offsets that weight a little bit.
Yeah.
But that in isolation only grows over time. The more investors you get on board, the more time your existing investors follow on and back you again, like, it just adds to that weight.
Yeah, 100%.
So it's, I personally, I think fear of failure is a much bigger motivator than the want of whatever the hell lies at the other end.
Yeah.
The pot of gold, whatever.
I think it, because if you live life like that, no one lives life like that, because if it was for the end, it would be when we're all in a box. Do you know
what I mean? Exactly. Yeah.
Like, it's the journey that is the exciting.
Exactly.
Thing. So if you don't have, and I love it, because no one has come here and been like, I'm doing this just for money.
Mm.
And I think anyone that does talk like that is like, just, I mean, it's just never going to work out like that, because, and if it does, you're probably one in a million, right? It's if you're not enjoying the journey, to your point, is you're a 7-year-old business.
Yeah.
Like, that's
exactly.
7 years of your life. You've got to enjoy the moments and the hurdles and getting there.
Definitely. I agree.
Amazing. Hi all, just quickly, I want to introduce you to my friends at Spring & Tonic PR, who are also this series' podcast sponsors. They are my own trusted PR partners for The Savourist. What I love about Spring & Tonic is it's run by two wonderful ladies, Emily and Jess. They're a small but mighty team. It is just the two of them, and thanks to years in the industry, they completely understand the startup, scale-up, food and drink space, and how to get meaningful cut-through in consumer and trade media. Having worked with some of the most successful and exciting names in food and drink, they really are an industry go-to. So if you're looking to make tangible difference to your business, build your brand equity through PR, I honestly would look no further. Get in touch with them at Spring & Tonic PR to find out more. Ta! One of the sort of ongoing themes when we're speaking to founders is switching off and sort of separating your personal life from your business life. Can you do that?
I think I find it easier to, like, physically, yes, I can put space in between and do different things.
Yeah.
But I think mentally it's really hard. I feel like for a lot of the time in the early years, you're your kind of mood is inextricably linked to the health of your business. And that can, for a small business, that can fluctuate week on week. And I haven't really found a way to separate that, to be honest. Maybe it will come with time. But again, I guess, it's an inconvenient truth, but I don't know whether to some extent that's good for your business, the fact that you can never really switch off. I know you're not supposed to say that.
No.
At what point, does the fact that you're always thinking about it mean you probably are going to preempt some more problems than if you weren't?
I completely agree. And I love that you have said that, because that's exactly what we want to do on this podcast, is tell the truth behind it. It's behind the business. And we've spoken to a couple of people about that. And it's the necessary evil, isn't it? Because it's your driver. That's the reason why White Rabbit's been so successful. But it's also potentially detrimental, and a lot of people would tell you, well, you can't do that. No.
Yeah, sure. It's bad for you. Sure. I mean, it's definitely got better over time, but I don't think it ever fully goes away. I'm not really sure how it could.
It's such an interesting one, isn't it? And finding those tools to try and switch off, I guess, is another thing. Like, is there anything you can share with the listeners that has helped you over time go like, okay, this is all consuming, and it's always going to be all consuming. Mm. Try and decompartmentalize it. Like, a lot of people say, they go off and someone was talking about go-karting, because you like, and he now goes go-karting regularly because it's like the only thing, because he's using everything in his brain.
Maybe I'll try that.
I think it was Stu from Manulife.
I'm rubbish at go-karting.
Yeah, me too.
So bad.
I'd love to see Theo go go-karting though.
Yeah, he'd be really good. I think being much more honest with people about if it's not going well at a certain time, actually telling them that. Because I think for a long time, if there's a difficult period, and someone asks, a friend asks you how it's going, and obviously the classic thing is always like, oh, it looks like it's going amazing, you're smashing it, whatever.
Yeah.
And when they say that, your heart just like sinks, because you're like, you feel like a bit of a fraud.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I think I just sat with that and like, it's all good. And now I'm just really honest. I'm like, this is good, but this is challenging. And they're like, and they probably regret asking. But I'm like really brutally honest now. If things are challenging, I'll just talk to them about it. And like, they probably don't want to hear it, but it helps me.
But it's key. It's a form of therapy, right? You're just getting it
definitely.
Out. You're getting it off your chest. I think like having, when you go back and you go back to sort of the White Rabbit pub, and then suddenly you're taking on Pizza Express. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course there's going to be fucking bits that you need to tell people where like, outside in it, you're smashing it. But there's a journey in there that has got to be unbelievably stressful, emotional, ups and downs, everything. Of course, there's got to be an outlet to just be like, bleh. And it's amazing that you can do that and find that.
Yeah, it takes a long time. I also, this is really weird. I watch a lot of space videos to get perspective. I've got like this one video that I watch a lot, which is like a time lapse of the universe from the Big Bang to like 100 trillion years in the future when the last star like runs out of energy. Wow. And I feel like that just separates me from my world and gives me like perspective on a really grand scale.
Yeah, I love that.
And I find that really therapeutic. Yeah. It's like,
I love that.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like nothing separates you from your.
Yeah.
And obviously, there's other. You know, you can tell yourself that you're lucky to be doing what you're doing and be grateful. And I do have a lot of gratitude for it, but I feel like something like that really just takes me out of that world completely and okay.
Yeah. Well, when you're looking at it that macro, it's like, does it matter if we sell another pizza?
Yeah,
I guess, and it pulls stuff back.
Exactly.
I think as well, like the really lovely thing in that is just finding what works for you and what helps you. And I think the piece as well on gratitude and being grateful for what you do, like it's all relative, right?
Yeah.
In life,
of course.
It's like you've got people that go, "Oh my God, you must be loving it, you're your own boss,"
but
for you it's your reality, and therefore there's always going to be challenging tough times.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's I feel a bit of guilt if I, not complain, but if I'm like brutally honest to people about the hard bits, because again, you also have to recognize that you're incredibly lucky to be doing what you're doing and in the position, you know, to do it and to have to be working for yourself and to be building something that is your own.
Yeah. But then you put yourself in that position.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're, like, no one's gone, here we go. Like, you've gone and
yeah, but also no one's forced me to do it either.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it works both ways. But I guess like that's where you have to, like, both can be true, right? You can simultaneously be really lucky to be doing what you're doing, and it can also be shit and stressful at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive, right?
No, absolutely. I think it's amazing, and I think there's always going to be anyone you speak to, there's always going to be parts of their job that they hate, and parts of their job that they love, and that's on a very different scale. That's exactly the same thing, right? Really,
and definitely
amazing. And I want to come on to like where. So you started building out a team. You've got your own factory. We spoke briefly before we started recording, and I had to shut myself up because I went straight into like, oh my god, what's that like? The factory piece, we had a really interesting conversation about founders that don't have their own factory in-house always want a factory. Founders that have their own factory. Talk me through the challenges of that. Like, I know you were speaking about how the factory staff is in different place, location. That's number one, right? But talk me through what you're going through at the moment with that.
Yeah, so I think to start with the fact that not a lot of other brands, you know, that you'll be speaking to week on week do it. I think that's tough in itself because you've got a kind of much more limited pool of people to ask for support.
Yeah.
Like we were saying earlier, I think probably less than 10% of startups produce in-house.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of unseen things, which unless you've built a factory before, there's just no way. I mean, similar to if you haven't started a business before, there's no way you could know what it actually entails.
Yeah.
It's the same with building a factory. Like the transitioning Teo's original project to a kind of semi-automatic production line was a big challenge. Like the product he was making by hand obviously wasn't the same as the one we first had on the line when we were about to launch into Sainsbury's. So that took a load of work. It's always more expensive than you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
You don't make the margin you think you're going to make for 4 or 5 years until you get scale. And I think, again, that's probably why from the outside it seems like it's a good thing to do because it's like, oh yeah, cut out the middleman and we make all that margin. But it's like, well, the scale you need to be and the slickness of operation you have to have to even get near that margin versus hopping on someone else's scale and production line and using it that way. I think a general rule of thumb is the more complex your product, the more sense it makes to do your own production, right? I mean, if someone else has already done the legwork for you for a product that can fairly easily be replicated, like, why the hell would you build a factory? Just spend all that money on team and brand and stuff like that. Yeah. I think for us, we're in quite a niche space. I mean, there's not many dedicated free from bakeries in Europe, I don't think. Yeah. So it does give us a strategic advantage. It does mean we can be more agile. It does mean we can maintain a certain level of quality that we wouldn't be able to get elsewhere. But equally, it's meant that, you know, most of the money we've raised to date with an outsourced brand, that would be spent on marketing. We've always had a very, very lean marketing budget and a pretty lean team, to be honest, because again, most of that resource has had to be spent getting the factory to scale.
Yeah.
So there's pros and cons. I think for us, it does make sense. I think it does give us a strategic advantage. And I think it's a big reason why we're still here today. But it is a massive undertaking. And I think, unless you pretty much have to. I mean, again, the reality is no one was really doing what we were doing at the beginning. Yeah. So we kind of had to just start up in a kitchen and then it just got bigger from there. Yeah. So it was kind of out of necessity. But if you don't have to do it, then I wouldn't recommend it. I think also Teo and I had a really unique combination of skills. Like he can look at a space and see a production line and where it flows and where the products come in and where they go out and how many people you need and all that stuff, and my brain just doesn't work like that. Like I can't do that stuff. So if I didn't have him, the business would look very different as well. So it was kind of a unique set of variables that led to us doing it in-house. But it's it's a massive challenge.
Yeah, and it must feel like two businesses at times.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for sure. And that again is a big challenge. You know, the factories in Oxford, the sales offices and the sales and marketing offices in London. So that in itself is difficult. So we try and spend 2 or 3 days a week at the factory with the ops guys there, just to get everyone close together. But yeah, even not being in the same building is a challenge, and one that we probably underestimated when we started.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a lot of work we're doing now is trying to get it to not be two separate businesses.
Yeah.
But again, you do have to actively work at that. I mean, in the early days when Teo was basically doing all of that side and I was doing all of the other side, that, you know, we didn't have a choice. We had to just crack on with our own bits. Like, I'd be raising money or doing retailer pitches or whatever, and he'd be making it and doing audits and everything else. And it kind of just had to be that way. But now we're just about other size, and we have the resource in terms of team where we can make a bit more of an active effort to spend time together and for each side to recognize the challenges of ops and sales and really understand what their roles entail.
Yeah.
And work together.
It's amazing, man. And I think it, what fascinates me and what's, I think, really exciting about the journey of particularly food and drink businesses, but I guess any business, is the different phases that you go through. So you're talking there about, like, in the early days where it's like completely split, and now you're obviously in a different phase where you've got a team and you're building the brand out a little bit more. Obviously, it's like different skill sets for different times, but also different enjoyment levels, I'd imagine. Like, talk me through that, just the difference in, like, team structure, in working a bit closer with Teo and getting everyone together now. Like, for you personally, are you enjoying it more now? Did you enjoy the kind of graft of the first stage? Like, talk me through what that looks like in your head.
Yeah, definitely. I did really enjoy it. I think it took Teo longer to be emancipated from the kind of the factory. I mean, he was still doing deliveries and he was still there 7 days a week. And, you know, he started off doing deliveries to Abel and Cole in our van. Like, he was literally doing everything.
Wow, yeah.
It took him a bit longer to be free of that side. But yeah, we learned so much. And I think it's important that I know what it's like to do a retailer pitch and, you know, make a P&L and whatever else. But for me, the most fulfilling part is building a team and looking around you and be like, there's some really talented people in this room, and they've chosen to follow what was just an idea five or six years ago. So that for me now is the most enjoyable part. You know, collaborating and leading a team of really passionate, like, people who care just as much as you do about your business and want it to succeed just as much. I think that is the most enjoyable and fulfilling aspect.
Amazing.
Now, definitely. Yeah. But yeah, we loved all the other bits as well.
It's so funny, isn't it? And you talk about it so eloquently, but as a founder, you are just constantly selling, because you're not just selling the product into retail or into food service.
Mm.
You're selling to investors who are going to put money into the business as a whole.
Yeah.
And to your point, the team that then join you, you're selling the business in, like, five different ways. And it's not just, here's a delicious pizza.
Yeah.
It's like, here's our culture and here's the aspirations of where I want it to go. And,
sure.
And by the way, I need you to give me some money. So here's what this business, it's crazy when you sort of look at it in all those different pieces. And I think a lot of founders get on and they go, I hate the sales side, or they say, I just don't like it. So, like, I instantly hire salespeople is what a lot of people will say. But actually, at the heart of it, you're selling constantly.
Because
even when you go and you say, you made a joke about how you when someone asked how it's going and you told them, and then you were like, I wish I didn't, like, it's still the dream of what you are, I don't know how to word it. I guess your world, right? It is your world, and it's constant, like, what you put out and what you take in. I think it's amazing. Quick one, I really want to talk to you about Bread and Jam. It's the UK's biggest community of food and drink founders and proud supporters of the Untold podcast. They run workshops, talks, network events and conferences that support emerging and scaling food and drink FMCG brands. Their main event, the jewel in their crown, is the Bread and Jam Festival in London each July. It's 2 days of jam-packed peer-to-peer knowledge, sharing where you can, learning from industry icons, meeting retailers, face-to-face pitching sessions, finding industry experts who can take your business to the next level, and the network till you drop. I have been the last few years, and I honestly cannot tell you how wonderful this event is. It oozes positivity. The energy in there is electric, and I've met some wonderful people there. I've had the privilege of sharing and chairing a couple of sessions there, and the whole thing is honestly unbelievable value for the cost of the ticket. Head over to their website, Bread and Jam, and I really hope I'll see you there. We are hosting an Untold live podcast from Bread and Jam this summer at the festival, so do come along and see us, and I really hope you guys sign up, because I honestly cannot explain how wonderful the event is. Cheers, guys. I want to come on to sort of what's next for White Rabbit. What does that look like? What's sort of around the corner for you guys?
I think that there's still a hell of a lot of work to do in retail. We're not in Tesco yet. Yeah. We're not in Asda yet. So retail will always be the heartland of our business. Equally, food service is a kind of revenue stream we really want to open up properly this year. Yeah.
And what does that, just for listeners that won't necessarily sort of put the two and two together, talk me through what that looks like from a food service perspective. Is that White Rabbit on a menu in a restaurant, or?
Yeah, exactly. So selling our gluten-free bases to pubs or restaurants who Amazing. Will then be able to top them and source them with their own toppings and tomato sauce. Yeah. That's a small part of our revenue mix at the moment, and we want it to be a bigger part. And just proliferation into other categories. So I think we wanted to really make a reputation for ourselves within pizza and chill pizza. Mm-hmm. And then we've moved to other dough products like the mini focaccias. And then we've got, pizzettas launching in May. We have a pasta that launched about a year ago, risotto and ambient. So I think, multiple categories, multiple channels and eventually multiple geography basically is the end goal. But for now we're really focusing on the heartland, which is retail and food service.
Amazing. And factory size, is that, are you at a point now where you're good for the sort of scalability element for the next few years?
Yeah, definitely. So we're good for the next 3 years. I think we front loaded a lot of investment in the factory, which is scary, because then you need volume going through it to make the margins. We invested in our factory to the point where it would get us to the three-year plan. And then it'd be the case of relocating or expanding the current line. It can get us where we need to get to in the next 3 years.
Amazing. There's so much, I'm sort of going back a little bit here, but there's so much complexity in having your own factory, right?
Yeah.
Like just when you talk about it, then you're like, for us at Savorous, we outsource, right? So it's an impulse-based snacking product. We outsource, we buy it, and then we sell it. And my margin is in between that, essentially. I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, but essentially it's that. For you guys, it's like overheads of people's time. Like
definitely.
Like electricity, how long you're running the machines for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And I guess this is often, my advice to people who want to do it in-house is, don't underestimate stability of margin. Like, yes, you might make more, but also just knowing exactly what you're making from every product you sell is so valuable. Versus some lines are X, some are Y. If you have a downtime for a certain month, or if labor goes up, you need to increase your labor costs. Like there's so many variables, and that can make it incredibly hard, especially in the early days, to forecast out.
Yeah.
Whereas at least if you know your overhead base, you know what margin you're making, it's much easier financially. There's a lot less variables to plug into the mix.
And then cash flow as well. Like we had Jeremy May from Nice Wine on. And he was saying that for the first couple of years of Nice, they were basically leveraging their outsourced manufacturers' finance invoice financing.
Yeah.
So he was saying that their model at the time, I mean, it's fucking genius. I don't know how they got away with it. Their model at the time, they would get paid by the retailers before they had to pay for their stock.
Wow.
The manufacturer. And I was like, wow, like it just sort of like, I was like, that is. So then when you look at like that, and then you look at guys are doing in your own factory, it's like, it's just worlds apart, right? And the extra complexity to what you guys have got to do, but that's why you have the product that you have, right? It's amazing.
Yeah. That was a really steep learning curve.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Just like you say, people's time, like all the overheads that you just don't really think of before. The downtime that you don't really think of, the cash that's tied up in stock ahead of a launch.
Yeah.
You know, your disproportionate logs costs at the beginning of a launch. Yeah. Like, all of those variables. Yeah, there were some pretty steep learning curves there.
Cash flow. I can imagine. Yeah. And would you ever, and excuse my ignorance, I should know this. Have you ever used the factory for like other brand, like if someone came to you and said, I want to use your machinery, like would you ever operate it as a manufacturer standalone from White Rabbit, like a white label stuff?
Not at the moment. I think although we do have headroom in terms of our capacity, I still think to use any of that precious capacity for anything that isn't the White Rabbit brand, I still think would be a mistake at this stage. So no, not at the moment.
Amazing. I'm not asking for any reason in particular. There isn't an agenda there.
I wish we could.
The underlying is, if you're looking to launch gluten-free pizza, do not email White Rabbit. Amazing, man. And so as we start to wrap up, I want to, where can listeners find White? So we've spoken about where you're stocked, but where can listeners, like, if they wanted to reach out and ask some advice to you, and where can they follow the brand and sort of engage with what you guys are doing?
Email me.
Yeah, nice.
I'm actually not on social media at the moment.
Okay,
deliberately.
Amazing.
So
yeah.
That's a bit harder, but yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. There's a story. There's something. What's driven that?
It's just a distraction. I just don't think it adds value to my life.
Yeah.
I think while I'm scrolling or whatever, I could be doing something better. Basically.
I love that.
So, I mean, I'm barely on LinkedIn. I should be on more for the business. Yeah, but even LinkedIn, I think, is essentially a form of social media.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And is a kind of toxic in the same sort of ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's all totally toxic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. And Hugh Thomas spoke about this so eloquently. I say spoke about this, still does.
Yeah.
Where he was saying that he, when Ugly was sort of on the way up, he used to go after that dopamine hit of likes and rushes, and he said that it put him in like the worst place mentally.
Yeah, definitely.
Because you're constantly searching for like the next, or you're comparing yourself. Like, a lot of people talk about it on social media as like they compare their body to like a model on the beach or whatever. But when you're running a business,
yeah, it's the same.
You're comparing yourself to like another listing or another brand, or like, and it can be quite detrimental, right?
Yeah, definitely. I choose not to engage in it more often than not.
Yeah.
Because it not deliberately, I don't think it's malicious, but I think that's kind of what it's become.
Yeah, of course.
And you do get the occasional like open up honesty post as well, which is like really refreshing.
Yeah.
But it's few and far between.
Yeah, agreed. It's like old school branding, LinkedIn, where like you look at like what Coca-Cola used to be and you see a logo.
Yeah.
And that is sometimes what I feel about content on LinkedIn, is like, here's me when the lights are turned on and I've done my makeup.
Yeah, definitely. Amazing. And everyone kind of knows it's bullshit.
Yeah,
it's,
but they still jump on the vibe.
Yeah, yeah. Engages with it and plays the game.
It's funny.
It's like we all know it's a bit of a game, but we do it anyway.
Yeah. It's weird. It's so weird. And this is, I mean, I've been guilty. I've been criminal in when we launched our savory snack bars, which haven't worked, and we've sexy word for failed, pivoted.
Yeah, exactly.
Into what we have now, and I was like so guilty of it, where you just look on LinkedIn and you're like, fucking hell, how have these guys managed to do that and we're not doing it? And like it is unbelievably detrimental to mental health.
Definitely.
And I think when that, like, these sorts of conversations I love, because it it sort of social media is supposed to open the bonnet and allow people to see underneath the hood, or come into your office and show people how cool your working environment. But it feels like we've only gone half the way there, because it's like, I'm now going to show you behind the business, but it's still bullshit. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's nuts. Like, I love it and I hate it, and I love to hate it, and I like everything about it. It's just a weird relationship, right?
Yeah, I guess the reality is you kind of have to be. You can't go completely dark.
No, yeah. Like,
if you have a brand, I think. The way I try to reconcile it is I try to be a little bit irreverent and not take it too seriously, and like a bit jokey with the posts, or I don't know, in my own little way. That's my like subtle protest.
I completely agree. Jeremy May, again, nice wine. He I don't know if you saw it, but he did a LinkedIn post and we spoke about it the other day, and it is fucking hilarious. Mm. I mean, his content is so funny. He had like his personal account, obviously not on the Nice Wine account, but they had someone that made a complaint, like a delivery arrived on a Saturday to the wrong address, and this lady who he calls Karen, like, wrote into their social media and was like, I can't believe this has gone to the wrong thing. And then Jeremy replied like 2 hours later, and then she posted on like Trustpilot and was like, these guys don't ever work, and it's gone to like the wrong. And Jeremy's like, obviously blocked out her name, but he's just like posting her comments on his social media, being like, give it a rest, Karen. Like,
that's
so funny.
I'm here for that kind of content.
And then he did a post on LinkedIn about how LinkedIn posts go, and it was basically like evolving, like. And it was like, I'm going to put insert inspirational comment here.
Yeah.
And then emoji here. Emoji
here. There's
and
a formula like, now. So I know. Good. It's just a bit tragic.
Oh, mate. It's funny. Another one that's quite good is the Dream Factory. Do you know Dream Factory? I'm giving them a plug here without any sponsorship, so I probably shouldn't. But they do all sorts of like content creation stuff. Mm-hmm. And the founder of that is jokes. Like when the last 6 months, when like every brand you're talking to has been raising, there's been a lot of brands that have put like by their name, like, we're raising.
Yeah.
And he uploaded his profile just saying, we're not raising. And I was like, it was good. Like, nice. I thought it was such a good ode to like just sort of like seeing through the bullshit.
Yeah, definitely.
Man, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I'm gonna ask you a question that we've asked all of our guests recently, and I'm not deliberately being rude with my phone, it's because I can't remember all of the guests.
Yeah.
Feels a little bit like, you know, that game when you were a child and you were like, I went to here and I bought an apple, an orange, and I just, my memory's just not that good. I'm running a dinner party. We're going to cook some unbelievable white rabbit pizzas. We have a guest list from every guest that's come on the podcast has bought a guest with them and told me why.
Right.
So far, we have Gary Neville. We have Phil Knight. We have Elon.
Phil Neville.
Yeah. We have Phil Knight, obviously founder of Nike.
Who's Phil Knight?
Founder of Nike. Oh, he wrote
Edit
Shoe
that
Dog.
Out. I should know that.
not at all. Elon Musk, and then Derek Sarno. Mm-hmm. So, like, quite an interesting. At the end of this series, we should have like 13 really eclectic, amazing guests that, I mean, if we can make it reality, it'd be probably cool, but we're not going to be able to make it reality. So hit me with who you think you would bring to that guest list and why.
I would have said Ricky Gervais, but I think it. His laugh and your laugh would be too much.
Be too much.
Yeah, definitely. So I'd go Brian Cox.
Amazing. Love it.
But
why?
As in the space, Brian Cox.
Yeah.
The Succession guy's cool as well.
Yeah.
But I love him. Like, I love how articulate he is. I love how he makes really complicated things make sense.
Yeah.
He's one of those people where I listen to him speak and I just agree with how he goes about saying stuff. And yeah, I don't know. A lot of what he says makes sense to my view of the world, I guess.
Yeah.
And I just love to ask him loads of questions about space.
Amazing.
And if there are aliens and stuff.
Yeah, I love it. Love it. That space theme is, I'm just going to write that down so that we've got it. That space theme has cropped up quite a bit.
I'm obsessed with it.
I think it's amazing, man.
I actually went to see Brian Cox live a few months ago.
Nice.
Yeah.
That, I mean, amazing. I think everything makes total sense about founder wanted to push boundaries, wanted to understand what's out there and what's big and push back. I love it, man. Anyway, there's enough waffle from me, but thank you so much for coming on Untold.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure to have you on. And to the guys listening, do go out. If you haven't tried White Rabbit already, do go out and try it. And you will not regret it. It's absolutely delicious. Thank you so much for giving us your time, lending us your ear. If you do like what we're doing, please do download, subscribe, share with your friends' friends' mum, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks so much. All the best. Ta-da. Bye. Thank you so much for giving us your time and listening. I really hope you've enjoyed. If you have enjoyed, please, please, please do download, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your friends' friends, tell your friends' mum's dog. It all really helps us grow the podcast, ultimately bring on more guests, which will be able to get us to give across more tangible takeaways. Thank you so much again. I'm Harry Turpin, your host, founder of The Savourists. We love you lots. Take care. Keep jingling.